What I'll do is I introduce the tape first. Today is April the 19th. I'm interviewing Russell McCummins at Mr. McCummins' home in McCain. My name is Dave Obringer. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Okay. And then that's all. For introduction, that'll be fine for the tape. Could you start by telling me how it is you got to Edinburgh? You know, what led you up to being there?
On May 26th, 1916, shortly before noon, I turned in my books and cleaned up my desk at the Albin Elementary School, got my report card, which was endorsed, promoted to 7th grade. I returned to an empty house, which had been home for about 7 years. While at school that morning, all of our household goods and worldly possessions had been loaded on Ray Thornton's dray, hauled by 2 mules, and already on its way to Edinburgh. Shortly after lunch, he piled my mother and 5 children into his Overland, one of about 3 cars in town, and we were on our way to Edinburgh. So that's how we got there. Now, my mother had planned the move with my oldest sister, having finished the 8th grade, because at that time anyone would go from the 8th grade into normal school. Mm-hmm. And that was the timing of the move. My father died 6 years earlier, about 1910. We arrived in Edinburgh, and Mother had made contact with Harriet Chapman, the secretary to Dr. Baker, through a relative in Albin. And she became a good advisor and friend. She said that although one could still enter Edinburgh Normal School after the 8th grade, spend 4 years and get the normal certificate, her diploma, she advised that my sister go through high school first. She said things are changing and be more advantageous to go through high school because this is probably the last year where they admit them out of the 8th grade in school. So that's how we happened to land in town.
So when a lot of your classmates were young, they weren't college age.
I was only 11, not quite 12. I was 12 in the middle of the summer. This is May the 26th. Uh-huh. So that first summer I had a chance to do a lot of exploring, and the campus fascinated me. I saw the tearing down of Old North Hall, which stood behind Academy Hall and the Compton Building. You could see it was a 3-story building. You'd see the roof over Academy Hall. Mm-hmm. That was torn down in the summer of 1916. And Science Hall, which was a building almost identical with Academy Hall, which stood near the corner of what was then Haven, at the point on the circular walkway opposite Recitation Hall. That was torn down also, and I helped Mr. Snyder. I was nothing else to do. I helped him carry Florence flasks, test tubes, Petri dishes, Bunsen burners, and small stuff over to the basement of Normal Hall, which had just been fitted up with physics and chemistry laboratories. New construction, 1916. He carried the big demijohns of sulfuric and nitric acids. And that building was soon down. I say torn down because in those days, they, instead of demolishing a building, they tore it down piece by piece and salvaged a lot of the lumber. And some of the lumber from Old North Hall, and possibly Science Hall, still stands in 3 very small cottages at the beginning of Lakeside Drive, just off of 6N.
Oh, really?
A manual training instructor there by the name of George Frost was also a carpenter, and he salvaged some of that lumber and built those 3 cottages with that material. Also, a house on Water Street in which he lived, just next to what we know as the Labonte House. He built that house with that same lumber and lived in that for a while, as long as in Edinburgh.
Wow.
Who'd have thought?
Were you ever inside of North Hall?
No, I never inside it. But I was inside of Science Hall as we were carrying the things out before they destroyed the building. Another thing that I noticed, Haven Hall apparently was a rectangular building about the same size and shape as Reader Hall. It got a beautiful veranda on the front. I noticed that what was the south wing next to what's the old gym apparently was new construction. I could see a vertical seam up to the corner of the building, almost indiscernible, but the mortar joined to the bonding, the brick was almost perfect, but still that was in evidence. A few years later, it completely disappeared. You wouldn't know there had been addition. The ground floor, I could see through the windows along the walkway, was concrete floor. There were a bunch of crates and boxes inside to begin with, and a door at the east end. Right behind that, just east of that, was a building, one-story building, about, say, 25 feet square, with a metal roof, and the door was slightly ajar. Well, what was an inquisitive 12-year-old kid supposed to do? To find out what's inside.
Yeah.
I pushed the door open. In the far corner, the northeast corner, was a pile of firewood. There were four little laundry stoves with stovepipes going up through the roof. And on each one was a copper wash boiler. There were four two-tub level wringer stands, two galvanized tubs on each stand. And in one of the tubs was on these old-fashioned scrub boards, zinc scrub boards. A short time later, the building disappeared. They tore it down. And I noticed inside the ground floor wing of Haven, just inside the door, was a large rotary washing machine, such as commercial laundries used for washing sheets and other laundry. Two rotary ironers, or we call them mangles. About a half a dozen modern washing machines. About a half a dozen ironing boards, each equipped with electric iron. So apparently they had been very primitive up until that time. And the last of the primitive stuff was abolished about the summer of 1916.
Now by that time, excuse me, Edinburgh had the power facility for running boilers so that everybody would have hot water heat.
Oh, they had a boiler house that stood right at the end of what would be the driveway in past Academy Hall, straight in, just before it makes the bend, just beyond Whitehall. Mm-hmm. That was about right at the end of the driveway. They had I think there were three moderately sized boilers, I forget what they said, 40 horsepower boilers, something like that, in a pit underneath a trestle where they'd haul coal in with trucks and dump it down from the over what would be a trestle to the ground floor level. On the southwest part was a generator room. They had two Burke electric generators, 110 volt DC Burke electric generators powered by Skinner reciprocating engines, all made in Erie, 110 volt DC. They also at that time had a transfer. They used steam from the boilers to power the generators. Well, the modernization, they had changed to a low-pressure heating system. They used the condensate from the generators to heat the buildings instead of wasting the exhaust steam. And they had a transfer switch where they could use regular 110 volt AC power from the utility at night after they shut the generators down. Mm-hmm. But that was, I don't know when that was demolished. The brick smokestack there, Pop Snyder later in our science class as a junior, he took us out and by triangulation we measured the shadow and calculated the height. It's 100 feet high. We came up with 99.84 hundredths feet, but
you didn't want to quibble over that.
That's
that
right.
Was settling. Now.
That's right.
Settling. Wow. You had quite a...
Now, Haven Hall, here's one thing where Dr. Vance's portrait of Edinburgh is in error. The north wing of Haven Hall, which contained the dining room and kitchen, he reports it as a three-story building with student rooms on the second floor and guest rooms and infirmary on third floor. It never happened. I watched the building of the dining room and the kitchen from the ground up. That was either the summer of 17, I believe. And later, Harriet Chapman told me that Dr. Baker, she had received a call from Harrisburg, the appropriation for that building was canceled, that wing was canceled. She said Dr. Baker was in shock, he couldn't believe it, called back Harrisburg, yes, it's true. She said the steel for the work for the second and third floor was on its way out of Pittsburgh. They called the steel mill to cancel the order that's already on its way. She said they contacted the state police, they flagged down the trucks around Mercer and turned them back and sent the steel work back. The second and third floor was never built and they roofed over the first floor, dining room and kitchen. And that was reportedly the most beautiful school or college dining room in the Commonwealth. It was beautiful.
You were in there?
Oh yes, yes, many times.
Mm-hmm. I understand that there were tables that you ate with tablecloths and you
were
served.
Oh yes, and they used some of the student boys as waiters, and the table service is elegant. Mm-hmm. The school started...
Now, how was the food?
What?
How was the food?
Oh, excellent, excellent,
really?
Excellent. They used ladies from town as cooks. They hired them, and they good home cooking. It was wonderful. Couldn't be beaten.
I brought with me, and this might you may not remember this, but before I guess this is a 1915 yearbook. Uh-huh. There's a man here who is named Harry Gracie, who is identified as the steward and chef.
I didn't know him.
No?
No.
Okay.
That was, what's that, 1915?
This is the 1915. That's
well,
right.
There's, yes, here's, no, I don't know any of those people.
Well, that's a year before your time.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I,
yeah.
I thought maybe
might be a holdover.
Yeah. Okay. Do you know if they grew any of their own food?
What is it?
Did they grow any of their own food?
Yes. They had the new kitchen there had a big walk-in freezer and they had a large basement. And I don't know just what year it was, but I remember that they out probably about where let's see, what's the hall next to Heather Hall? Is that the one next to as you go in past Academy Hall, that small girls' dormitory.
Haven.
No, no.
No, that's what we're talking about.
There's a building still exists there now.
There's a White Hall right behind.
Well, no, well, that's beyond that. Well, beyond White Hall and to the east, they did have large gardens. They raised a lot of garden vegetables. And I remember of seeing Amos Salee later on. He was superintendent of building grounds with the a dump truck hauling loads of potatoes from that field and hauling them over and dumping them in the basement under the kitchen for storage.
Wow.
But they did raise, they had fresh vegetables in season, cooked mm-hmm. in the kitchen, served in the dining room. and they've started potatoes and other root vegetables for winter.
Wow. They didn't have any livestock, did they?
No, no.
Okay.
Although one rather interesting thing, we lived for 2 years on West Normal Street, on the north side of the street, about midway between Meadville Street and the creek. The second spring, we noticed the whole lot was sinking almost a foot. We inquired what had happened. Well, didn't you know? That's the cesspool for the normal school.
Oh.
They had excavated a whole building lot, put pillars in, floored it over, put a foot or two of dirt on top, and all of the raw sewage was dumped in there and overflowed into the creek. Needless to say, we moved because we had an earthen basement.
Yeah. What was the, of course, now the campus is much bigger now.
Yeah.
And it extends further, I guess it would be east?
East.
Okay. We're now as the lake, Mallory Lake, and the library and the field house. What was there?
That was a swampland.
Just a swamp?
It's a swampland. They cleared it out and enlarged cleared the swamp to make a small lake there. But it was just a small stream. I don't know where the headwater stream was running down through there and on to the south. But it was swampland. And the campus at that time, the only buildings were Normal Hall, Recitation Hall, Haven, the gym, and Reader, and of course Academy Hall, which at that time was called Music Hall because the music was over that department.
Right.
That was Owen White Hall and a boiler house.
Mm-hmm. It was pretty compact there. Who were some of your teachers when you were a student there?
Well, when I first went there, I was in the seventh grade. And that was in a white building over on High Street. It was called a model school. It was supported by the normal school at that time.
It was on High Street?
High Street. That's where the Methodist Church now is. It parallels Meadville Street, just one block.
Okay.
Runs right into the street past Academy Hall.
Okay.
About midway between Normal Street and Waterford Street was a large white building. Four classrooms on the first floor, two classrooms, an assembly on the second floor, two large basement rooms. I didn't think much about it at the time, but I think about it later. The school board of many years ago in Edinburgh should get the leather medal for sewage disposal. They moved the outhouses into the basement of that building and excavated a large pit below the level of the basement floor on the street side of the building. The partition in the middle, on the south side, that was the boys' room, three steps up to a platform and six stalls, emptying down into a pit underneath the building. I assume the girls on the other side arranged probably the same. How many years that went on, I don't know. But they moved the outhouse into the basement of that building.
Sort of like indoor facilities then.
Right. And I believe it was 35 or 36 when they got sewers up in that area and got sanitary toilets in the building.
Well, was the ventilation adequate for this?
Oh yes, yes. They had a large chimney up there, vented the furnace as well as toilets. But I remember one hot September day, some of the older boys, a prankster, lighted a piece of paper and dropped it down in there. They had to close the school for the rest of the day. The stank was horrible.
I'll bet it was.
One of the things I remember in seventh grade, Miss Powell was the drawing and penmanship teacher, as they called it in those days.
Miss
Powell.
Powell.
Miss Powell. She came over once a week I can still see her wire rim glasses on the end of her nose. One day she came over with a small pamphlet. Copies enough for everyone in the 7th and 8th grade in that one room. And she gave us instructions as to what to do, but her name's not, but not to touch it till she told her she had a stopwatch. Years later, it occurred to me that I was a guinea pig. They were apparently standardizing the first Army Alpha intelligence tests. I learned that later that when the war was imminent, that some of the top brass in the Army went to, I believe, Columbia University and contacted a couple of psychologists, Terman and I forget some of the others. They said, we're charged with the responsibility of raising an army of about 3 million men. We understand you have some sort of an intelligence test. We'd like to see if that could be used to classify them. They said, well, this is a Mene Simone, that's an individual test, but well, could it be adapted to a group test? Well, yes, we think it could. So apparently they adapted that group test, and this was the first printing, the standardization, because years later some of the same questions that I encountered in the 7th grade in 1916 appeared later, years later, the intelligence test I took years later.
Wow.
So I knew I was a guinea pig, and they were standardizing the first group intelligence test, the Army Alpha, I understand. That was the first one.
So then you saw the school through the war, through World War One.
World War One, yeah.
And up to the beginning of World War II. But did World War One have much of an effect on Edinburgh?
Yes. My teacher, Ruby Anderson, married his name was Austin, just before he went overseas, and he was killed the day after the armistice by a German sniper. Mm. Well, that sort of shook up the town.
Was this one of the Austins, a descendant of Nathaniel Austin, that built the academy?
That I don't know. I have no idea. I didn't know him at all. I knew that she supposedly married just before he went overseas, and didn't know anything about him, but that was all I know is that he got word that after the arms, the German sniper shot him, and that sort of shook things up a bit.
I'll bet.
Also, Olivia Thomas, who lived right next door, she was a music teacher. She came over once a week and gave us music instruction. I still remember she'd bring over classical records, and with the old horn-type Victrola, she'd play Tramarai and Barcarolle and many of those. I've never forgotten them.
Yeah.
She gives a real appreciation of music. That was through the 8th grade. Then I had the 9th and 10th there. The last 2 years were over on campus. Been going on for several years. So on September 8th, 1921, I set foot on campus for the first time as a student. The normal school is very small. I don't think they have more than 100 students. And this was augmented by probably 50 or 60 junior and senior high school upper secondary department. So I had normal school instructors, good instruction in the last 2 years. And about mid-morning, the first day of school, I met a buddy of mine. He was a senior. As we passed him in the hall, he said, hey, Russ, we can get mechanical drawing this year. They got a new art teacher, Mr. Bates. We were right about opposite end there. He says, they're an N3, so go rap on the door. He'll take care of it. Real nice guy. So I met Mr. Bates first time, enrolled in mechanical drawing, mm-hmm. 5 hours a week. It wasn't long until I was in all my spare periods, 10, 12 hours a week. I was in there all the time. And he started the department with one special art student, Gertrude Bensinger from Oil City, a former student of his, one of his high school students. The school code is amended in 1919, required art and music as part of the common branches, along with English, history, math, science, and all. And all elementary teachers were required to take two courses. One art, one which drawing, painting, and design. Art two was handicrafts, elementary industrial arts. Well, that was the backbone of the department those first 2 years, but other than that, Mr. Bates ran a three-ring circus. Electives, you could take whatever you want. One person this, two people this, and everything was going on in a multimedia classroom, N3. Mechanical drawing, lettering, pastel, oil painting, leathercraft, bookbinding, you name it, everything.
This was all going on at one time?
All at one time, yes.
And Mr. Bates would go through
the room? Keep it all going, yeah.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything he couldn't do or demonstrate, barring none. He was gifted, he was a genius, more than a genius. Well, it so happened that it wasn't long until he called me Bus, because for some reason, everyone in Edinburgh whose name was Russell was called Bus, nicknamed Bus. My wife hates it. She hated it. She knew I was using it even here. It wasn't long ago, Bus, will you show so-and-so what to do next? Or will you help so-and-so? So it wasn't long until I was an unofficial assistant instructor, helping here and there, lettering. I was mechanical drawing, lettering mainly, although other things as well that I'd seen going on. So, the end of that year, the summer school, he brought in Anna J. Lamphere from north out of Massachusetts, a friend, professional acquaintance of his, to teach the handicrafts, the industrial, the art two. He handled the art one, and I don't know how many were, but the enthrallment was substantial. He had gone out, he taught teachers in high school classes, and when the flood came in, he really expanded the school.
So Waldo Bates recruited students?
Oh yes, yes. As a matter of fact, about that time, Edinburgh was threatened with closing twice. He literally saved the school from extinction. And one of those occasions, I don't know which one it was, Edinburgh was scheduled to be a juvenile detention rehabilitation center for juvenile offenders. It's already planned in Harrisburg. That was it. Zipped. Well, I think that was the second year. Well, the summer of 21 was when Miss Lamphere, he was there. He published a small pamphlet to art education for guides or elementary schools. I don't know, maybe one of those in the archives, I hope. And in September 21, we moved up to the third floor of Norma Hall. It was the process of renovation. He designed the whole thing, gave the information to the architects and all. They put skylights in the roof, one main partition. There was one very large room, another about half the size of it, and they had movable partitions dividing the two. September 1921, I guess about the middle of the morning, I had taken a class in advanced mechanical drawing. I'd milked him practically dry. He had me through mechanical drawing, French's third edition engineering drawing, field architectural drawing. I was just eating it up. I was way ahead of anybody else. Of course, we're working at individual speeds. See. So September 21, the first day up in the art room, he had a class. On one side of the partition, there was a high school mechanical drawing class on the other side. He handed me the roll book. He said, here, check the attendance, keep around this. I'll pop in once in a while. I didn't see him the rest of the year. I had the class. I taught the class and did my own work, see. So that summer, The enrollment largely due to his efforts swelled to 551 students, an unheard of number. These were the things that saved Edinburgh. There was a third attempt to close Edinburgh. I don't recall the year when they gave Indiana the right to grant bachelor degree in public school art. Originally it's Kutztown in Edinburgh, east and west end. Well, what was happening? They were determined to close Edinburgh, someone, I don't know where or how. And apparently the question came up, what's keeping Edinburgh alive? Waldo Bates in the art department. Get Waldo Bates. How do we do it? Kill the art department. Give Indiana the right to grant degrees. Starve them out. It didn't work. We became stronger. 1923, well, that summer, Miss Lamphere and Mr. Bates published another guide to elementary teachers for elementary industrial arts in the elementary school. It was the second publication. So the Art 1 and Art 2 class were the backbone of the department, the volume. First year, Gertrude Bensinger, one student, special art. As well as the summer school in 21, two elementary teachers who were caught in these classes, they'd spotted them. Nina Gleaton, Edinburgh, she'd been teaching in one-room school, and Paul Hilton Sharon. They entered the art department as special art students, so we had three that second year. The third year, Elsie Shoddy, a girl from Erie, transferred from Pratt Institute, New York, to Edinburgh, and Ruth Pope Turner transferred from Carnegie Tech, Pittsburgh, to Edinburgh. Graduating in class of five, 1923, the first three-year class graduated, five of them. Well, Mr. Bates did another thing then. He took the pictures, the plates from the yearbook of those five people. He had them printed in a brochure with a resume of each of them. He sent that to every school district, every school superintendent in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, advertising the five students, but advertising Edinburgh. That continued in 1935, every class. As a result, we drew students from Philadelphia, Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area, Harrisburg, all over the state, and some few from out of state gathered in. That was one of the big things that he did too. He not advertised for graduates, but he advertised Edinburgh because they weren't supposed to advertise outside of their service area.
That was a way of getting around it.
He got around it. The whole state was blanketed.
That's pretty clever.
And, another thing, I think it was the first summer. Upstairs, 21. He was gone for 3 days. I covered some of his classes while he was gone. Nobody knew why or how, but a few days after he got back, he told me that he'd been to New York City. He had been offered a position as education director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Wow.
He turned it down. He said he felt he could do more by training teachers and supervising public school art than he could in a situation of that sort, where he'd be dealing with a few. So he dedicated his life, really, to Edinburgh. Going back to just before Christmas, 1921, I'd usually meet him at the front of the building outside the principal's office. He'd pick up his mail, and we'd climb the winding stairs up past the clock and on the front entrance. Oftentimes we'd half run to break the monotony at his count of 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, up the stairs we'd go. Short before Christmas, a telegram in the mailbox. We got up at the head of the stairs, Ruby opened it up, and he passed over for me to read. Quote, Waldo F. Bates and so on. Doucette colorblind. Stop. Do you still want him? Stop. Signed, Royal Bailey Farnham, head of the Massachusetts School of Art. Wait, that was in 22. Yeah, just before Christmas, 22. I'd been teaching that mechanical drawing lettering class and filling in all the time. Well, he went in the office and he typed the report. He showed it to me. He had a lot of faith in Dr. Farnham because he apparently knew him quite well. The telegram read, if you think Doucette's the man for us, send him. Signed, Waldo Bates, that went. So Doucette arrived about mid-January, 23. Young, rash, immature. One of his classes, well, the second year class, Jimmy Townley, Burton Morgan, Claire Thomas, Lithner Peterson, four or five girls. On the first days, he gives some instruction. Jimmy Townley said, would you mind repeating that? And Doucette snapped back, what's the matter? Don't you understand English? Jimmy said, yeah, we understand the kind of English you speak around here, but if you talk so we can understand you. Doucette started down with clenched fists, and little Jimmy, pretty stocky, got up to meet a halfway, he backed off. Well, that didn't work, so he started wooing them in another way. He was living single then in a little house on West Normal Street on the south side of the street just next to the creek. He'd take the roll, give a class assignment, take the boys down to his pad, home brew and cigarettes. Jimmy Tomlin told me later, he said, I make my first home brew and smoke my first cigarette down at Doucette's place that year. Jimmy later became supervisor of Iowa City on graduation. So he was a real pain those first 2 years. He might have redeemed himself in later years, but
Well, that leads me up to about the right time period. I was going to ask about Prohibition.
About what?
Prohibition.
Prohibition. Well, that's another thing. In 1922, Charles Larkin was still supervising principal. There was a problem of petty thievery going on around the campus, around the gym and other places. Stealing small amounts of money here and there. Mr. Crawford then, and Mr. Larkham, supervising principal, got together. By that time, they brought the rest of the high school over on the campus. The 7th grade through 12th was on campus that last year, 23, right after I graduated. They hired a private detective to see if they could solve this problem. His name was Roy Mong. He later became a county detective of Erie County. Well, he was enrolled as a special arts student, taking show card writing and lettering. Well, I was let in on. I was probably beside Mr. Bates, Mr. Barkham, Mr. Crawford. I was probably the only one who knew this because I had charge of the stock room and it said to set up an account. He'd have anything he wanted, just charge with special accounts. So he was there for several weeks, I don't know, long into the winter. His report, when he finished, ready to go, was this, that you won't solve this problem unless you solve the liquor problem. Practically every other house in Edinburgh is either making home brew or they have a still in the basement. And Doucette's house was one of those on the list.
His being the home brew, I guess.
home brew, later a deadline wine. Well then, and Doucette came about mid-January of 23. His field was design, and it became obvious pretty early that he wasn't going to be able to contribute much to the public school art program because he couldn't draw, couldn't see color. Although he got by, how he ever got through Massachusetts art, I will never know.
Really?
Because one summer, years later, well, Mr. Bates always had a class in outdoor painting and oils. He loved to do that. That was his favorite. He wasn't vindictive, and it's the only thing that time that I ever know that he attempted to put anyone in their place. He assigned Doucette to that class that summer. Mm-hmm. How can anyone paint or draw if they can't see color, see? Because he had to paint with the students. Doucette got empty tubes. He had his wife mix paints according to the Moncel classification system, which is a numerical classification of color. A normal red was R5, fraction 5 over 5, indicating the hue, the value, and the chroma, see? She mixed the paints, put them in tubes, sealed up the bottom of the tube, and labeled the tubes, and he marked his palette, Well, how can anyone paint anything when they can't see it? He came in after the first day with a painting. I never saw such a gosh-awful mess of purples and grays and mud. You can't imagine it. Well, that was the last time he ever painted with his class. He took them out. He told them how to do it, but he never touched the thing yet. I can still see that painting. Awful. Well, a little earlier, I think this is first the summer of 23, toward the end of summer school, he had contacted one of the Northeast canning companies to make a design for a label for their tomatoes. Mr. Bates and I were up in the art department. Remember the one west room on. He came up late afternoon, picked up some mail, this envelope, which he hadn't opened up. Came up, opened up in front of us, apparently going to show off something, pulled out this print. He put a dimension on the top and on the bottom of the thing. Apparently, for some reason, I don't know, but the whole length thing, well, the printer, the engraver misinterpreted, so they pulled the picture in as a trapezoid label, and brilliant flaming red tomato. I never saw a tomato that color in my life. Of course, he didn't see the color, but he saw the shape. He's, oh, they don't know what they're doing. He slapped back the envelope. That was the last of that. But
he was there for quite a long time.
Oh, a long time. And how got by, I will never know, because in one class, a couple of fellows, a friend of mine, Paul Davis and John Davis, they roomed together. And Ducey had his favorites. And he didn't like Paul for some reason. Paul later became art super in Westmoreland County. Stayed there for 40 years. He was all over Westmoreland, Allegheny, student teaching supervisor for Seton Hill. Real individual. Set didn't like him for some reason or other, apparently because he was good. One morning, Johnny was sick, a cold or flu or something, and he didn't go, so Paul brought his painting in for evaluation. He came in, he put his down first, and a little later on, put his own. Giuseppe put that painting down, he thought it was Paul's. Ripped it apart, couldn't find anything good in it at all. Terrible, horrible. Who could paint anything like that? See, Paul didn't say anything. Went on, finally came to Paul's. He praised that one. Whose is this? Paul's, that's mine. Hey, I thought that was yours down there. No, that's Johnny Davis. He's sick, he didn't come in this morning. I brought it in for him, see. Well, so Ducey went back for reevaluation. He found everything good in that painting. Another occasion, that same group, my sister in the group, a fellow by the name of Wayne Martin, Abe Martin they called him, very talented fellow, something eccentric, but they had one of the assignments was design the Christmas seal, the Tuberculosis Society in those mm-hmm. days. They had competitions, high school and college, and then to send them into the county level. Well, my sister designed one. It was, I can still see it. It was a ship in a foaming ocean and the billowing sails out with a double-barred cross on it. Dizzy ripped that apart, called it an ivory soap ad, ridiculed it. Some months later, this went into county competition. She got first prize in the county competition, a couple dollars, I guess, and Wayne Martin got second a dollar or so. Didn't think anything about it. Some months later, when the Christmas deals came out, there was that design. Mm-hmm. Almost identical. Well, the kids in the class spotted it. Hey, you see, think you old, they called her Mickey. Oh, Mickey, an apology. There's her ivory soap ad. He said, I don't know anything about it. I still think it looks like an ivory soap ad.
Wow.
One other occasion, this really was something. He severely criticized Abe Martin's painting or something. Abe shot back to him, what's the matter, are you colorblind? He didn't know. The next thing, a couple of girls running, Mr. Bates, come quick, they're fighting.
Oh, wow. It was a fist fight?
What? They got the blows.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, and another thing, though, about that same year, yes, I was June the 1st, latter part of May, 1923, I got this letter from Dr. Crawford. Dear Russell, I lost the letter way back, but I remember the condition. Dear Russell, I've been authorized by the Board of Trustees to offer you employment as instructor in the art department effective June 1st, 1923. Your duties will be assigned by Waldo F. Bates, Jr., head of the art department. A few other little things I don't recall, signed C.C. Crawford. Yet apparently, I had been unofficially teaching in there, and apparently they realized that Mr. Bates was going to need some help, which he wasn't going to get from Doucette, so I did 3 years in mechanical drawing. That was the requirement for a normal school instructor, was 3 years in your special field. So, mm-hmm. So I became a member of the faculty as instructor of mechanical drawing 2 years before I graduated from the department.
Wow. But you had like a normal certificate or something?
No, you didn't have to have a normal certificate in those days. Normal school instructor, just so you had high school education, uh-huh. because we were training elementary teachers. 3 years experience in your chosen field, history, science, whatever it is. So they gave me credit for 3 years in mechanical drawing, named me as instructor in mechanical drawing. Well, I was teaching other things as well, but that put me in the back door, see.
So you were on the faculty.
And a student at the same time.
Same time.
That's why I wanted to see if it got in the, yearbook, but I wonder if it got in the, and I think of the faculty is 25, I went about 24, see, so
I'll send you a copy.
Okay, but it was in the yearbooks as the picture, instructor mechanical drawing. So that's one thing I asked Barb the other day after the awards went down. They had Doucette arriving in 1920. I said, hey, how come they never have me down as that? She said, well, you didn't graduate at 25, did you? I said, I know I didn't, but I was teaching before I graduated. I said, check the yearbooks. You'll find me in the yearbook there.
Yeah.
So, but I attend all faculty meetings. I was faculty and student at the same time. Unusual. As a matter of fact, the, let's see, 23. Yes, I had my first official class in the summer school of 1923. I think I had 7 students. I remember it well because one of the students was the mother of one of my high school classmates, Mary Timmons. Her mother was in my class that summer, a small class. Well, then that summer, it was 9 weeks in session at that time, the normal school. I went 6 weeks to college. In 6 weeks in a sub-school, I was spending a weekend over at Finley Lake as a house guest. I got home Sunday night about late because I had to take the train to Cambridge, Finley Lake, to Cory to Cambridge Springs, the trolley from Cambridge Springs up to Edinburgh. Got home about 11 o'clock shortly after. But there's Mr. Bateman calling all afternoon. He said if he got home before 11 to call him, if not to be over school 7:30 in the morning. Over bright and early the next morning. Doucette had an attack of appendicitis. Couldn't climb the stairs for the last 3 weeks of summer school, so I took over his Art 1 classes, as well as my own teaching.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Crawford, I met him when he first came. I was a grocer boy in 17 or 18, delivered groceries there, got acquainted with his wife, and got to know him. And he told me a lot of things. He confided a lot of things in me through the years. Well, after that summer was over, he told me, he said, he still had a little chuckle, he said that a lot of students came to him, hey, I like what Mr. McCommons taught him a lot better. He said they taught him something he could use. Well, I was using only Bates's outline.
Mm-hmm.
Doucette refused to use his outline because he couldn't draw, he couldn't do these things, you see. He couldn't see color, drawing, design, and color. And he was teaching principles of design from a little book, I still have the book, Applied Drawing by Brown. Little squares and triangles, repetition, alternation, little border designs in charcoal gray water paint, little borders, this that's it. Stuff a public school teacher never used in elementary school for 6 weeks of nothing, see.
Well, how is it, do you think, that he became important enough to Edinburgh to have a building named after him?
Well, I think I know. And this gets back to another thing. In the beginning, he started raising a family. He had another child every year, one after the other, you see. He's raising a family on an income that he couldn't afford. So it wasn't long after he got there that he started, he'd call a class to order, give an assignment. They're usually 2-hour studio periods. And then he'd disappear. He'd go out and do interior painting or wallpaper hanging in the wintertime and interior and exterior painting in the summer. He'd come back at the end of 2 hours, dismiss the class, take the assignment in that class, and away he'd go, see. Well, Dr. Crawford, Mr. Bates, tolerated it in those early years because of his wife and ever-increasing family, see. But one summer, almost in the beginning, he figured he ought to be head of that department. He did everything he could to crucify and stab Mr. Bates. Matter of fact, 2 or 3 years ago, I was talking to Rose Laycock, another one of our assistants. Incidentally, Rose came in. She graduated in 22, taught for a year. She was in the summer school. Bates spotted her. She came to the art department in 23 and finished in 25 in my class. She I was there until 26 out of Westmoreland County. She joined the faculty in 25, she's there till 28. Well, they were pushing for degrees, and Dr. Crawford then told her, Teachers College then, told her, said, Rose, he said, you're going to have to get a degree, or I won't be able to keep you. The pressure's great. Well, she went to Peabody for a year, and then, as fate have it, she didn't return. I guess she went to California for a year or so, and then she landed the University of Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, for 40 years, a professor there, spreading Mr. Bates' philosophy. Rose and I were the only two that completely absorbed Mr. Bates' philosophy. Well, the what happened here, I thought, oh yes, the along about 32 or 33, Dr. Crawford attempted to get, I don't know what Doucette did, but Dr. Crawford attempted to get rid of him. As a matter of fact, one summer, Mr. Bates and two or three of them went to State College for a post session. He's going to get his master's degree down there. Doucette did something, I don't know what it was, but pulled some underhand trick, and Mr. Bates never left Edinburgh again. I don't know what he did. But it was, he was really something in those early years. Well, in 32 or 33, Dr. Crawford tried to get rid of him. And this is a secret I've kept for 60 years. Maybe now it's time to tell it.
It is. As far as I can see.
He told me that word had come from Harrisburg to back off. He said the bishop of the diocese had interceded and Amy Doucette would never leave Edinburgh, quote, except of his own volition, unquote. Now shortly after that, Dr. Crawford asked to be relieved of the presidency. That's when Dr. Ross came in. And I believe he's assigned the teaching staff for a year or so. His health failed, and shortly after he died, I think, as a result of that. Now, that I know to be true because 20 years later, about 1952, I was at a fraternal organization meeting, and I struck up a conversation with a resident of Edinburgh, identified only by the initials BF. We got to talking at Edinburgh. When he found out I'd been on the faculty, you know, just said, yeah. He said he tried to take all the credit for establishing Our Lady of the Lake Church, but he said a lot of others had just as much to do with it as he did. And one thing led to another, and I mentioned the fact that about 32, Dr. Crawford had tried to get rid of him, and I quoted what Dr. Crawford had told me. He said, yes, I remember the incident. Quote, we had very powerful friends in Harrisburg at that time, unquote, Catholic friends. So Doucette used his religion. I don't know what yours is, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
But he used it to the nth degree, and I think through the Alumni Association, I think he used it to get that hall named for him, too.
The his religious connection?
Yes. But he had another incident. The student by the name of Earl Kyle, senior there, he was a top student, A student right straight through. In fact, matter of fact, I used him some years later when I was at the University of Virginia Extension Division. I brought him down there for summer school off campus teaching for two, three, or four years. He was tops. Doucette's going to flunk him in jewelry making design. He asked him why. He said, you didn't finish your chain, gold, silver chain. Duke said, well, I was waiting for you to show me how to solder it. He said, I told you how. He said, yeah, but I don't understand. I'd like to see you do it. Wouldn't do it. He passed him with a D. Didn't flunk him. You know why? Why he couldn't settle that chain? He couldn't see the color of that tip of the alcohol burner. Change of color, he couldn't see the color. He could not do one single thing. He couldn't draw, he couldn't paint, he couldn't solder a link in a chain. He couldn't do anything, but he could tell anyone. He had it all right. And he got by with it.
It's amazing.
Well, I didn't mean to really get into that, but the...
That's fine, that's fine, don't worry. Tell me more about Dr. Crawford. You knew him from the time you were a grocery boy.
Yeah.
You knew him as an employee, yeah, also. Was he
was a prince, fine man. I remember when he first came, he was assistant principal, Professor Baker, and he first lived in what had formerly been the Wayside Inn, which is where the telephone building is located in Edinburgh right now. And I remember of Mrs. Crawford and three children, Wayne, Isabel, let's see, Stanley, Isabel, and Anne. I got acquainted with him. Well, I don't know. He took a liking to me, and apparently he'd think there wasn't anything I couldn't do. He was vice principal, and while I was in high school there, and then on into the college. I remember one day, I think it was 19 fall of school had just begun. It's either 22 or 23, we're up in the art department. Telephone Mr. Bates' office rang, he came out, he said, Russ, he said, Mr. Crawford can't get into his desk, he wants you to go down and open it up for him. Well, I knew what had happened. As an old, went over these old-fashioned desks, there's a bar that latched the drawers in, is tied into the cam and the center drawer, see. So as I went past the sink, I picked up a small bar of ivory soap and I went down, I crawled under the desk, I released the thing, soaped the friction points, crawled out under the desk. I crawled out, I saw at the left-hand side of the door to his office a beautiful clock, about 5 or 6 feet tall, seconds.